From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Across the country, millions of people are suddenly finding themselves in federal hazard zones. It's not because of any actual disasters. It's because the Federal Emergency Management Agency is updating its old flood risk maps. Owners of homes and businesses in places deemed hazardous have to buy flood insurance or risk losing their mortgages, even if they've never been flooded. And in southwestern Illinois, there are serious fears that these revised maps could snuff out the early flickers of an economic recovery. Matt Sepik of St. Louis Public Radio reports.
Like other steel towns, the boom times for Granite City, Illinois are long past. But look closer, and things aren't so bad in this old industrial community across the Mississippi River from St. Louis. The main mill has rehired laid-off workers, and a nearby oil refinery is expanding. Floods were common here until the federal government built 64 miles of levees in the mid-20th century. For decades, these serpentine grassy mounds of compacted soil reliably held back the Mississippi. But Troy Cosgrove with the Army Corps of Engineers says after repeated soakings, the river is seeping underneath.
In 93, we had a significant flood. And then in 95, we had a lower level flood. And we were actually seeing seepage as bad as we were in 93 and 95.
Now, as part of a nationwide review of its flood risk maps, the Federal Emergency Management Agency says this part of southwestern Illinois should be designated a hazard area. That triggers mandatory flood insurance for many businesses and homeowners here. Granite City Mayor Ed Hagnauer says a federal hazard designation would go too far and will upset a delicate economic balance.
All of a sudden, they're treating us as if we don't even have levees out here. They're saying that these levees don't even exist.
Hagnauer and others say FEMA is being overly cautious because of the fallout from Hurricane Katrina. But the agency's Pat Glitherow says flood maps are only about public safety.
FEMA wants people to understand the risk. Long before Katrina, FEMA was mandated and made a commitment to update those maps so that people knew more precisely where the floodplains were, and what risk they face.
One thing you don't hear in this area is that everything's fine. Even with a recession looming, voters passed a sales tax to fix the levees. And to ease financial concerns, FEMA is now offering discounted insurance to home and small business owners. A few hundred yards from a levee, workers at Heitman Steel clean and slice 30-ton rolls of metal for everything from truck fenders to lawnmower blades. Manager Gene Cope says to compete globally, he needs to expand this plant, but he says bank loans are tough to get in hazard zones, and he fears for the worst.
It would be a catastrophe. Everybody would have to, you know, file bankruptcy. The businesses would go away. Housing would be decimated. The whole valley would turn into a ghost town.
That's a common concern here, but Andrew Theising of Southern Illinois University Edwardsville says the most dire predictions will probably not come to pass.
I don't think it's going to have a drastic effect, but there are some businesses out there. They're hurting. The recovery is slow, and this could be the straw that breaks camel's back, but it would be on a case-by-case basis.
Aside from the tension over flood maps and hazard zones, local officials say the biggest challenge facing lowlanders here is fixing the levees. Cost estimates for that are in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and the project might not begin for years. But unless the area's politicians succeed in delaying FEMA's flood mapping plan, the new hazard zone and the costs that go with it will go into effect in time for next year's flood season. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in St. Louis.
Let's face it, when it's hot, a lot of us get drowsy, and it reached 98 degrees here in Washington today, so we're just going to pause for a moment for a little nap. Because as our science correspondent Robert Krolwich reminds us, every so often a summer nap can be very exciting.
There's a psychology professor at the University of Michigan, Barb Smuts. She once studied wild baboons in East Africa, and when she's in the field, she's kind of like a hunter. She's so attentive and so sharp, and in that state, she says,
things happen when you spend time in wild places. Things things happen that you can't explain.
So one time she was in the woods.
Yes, I was back home in Michigan, and I was camping. I was walking through the forest.
And to put you in the right frame of mind, we've added the sound of a Michigan forest on a beautiful day. So imagine her walking along.
Then I stopped walking and just stood still. I just wanted to experience the forest around me. And after I'd been standing for a while, I heard this little rustle in the leaves, and then out popped this little mouse, and I'll call her she. I don't know whether it was male or female, but and she was a couple feet from me, which was pretty close, and I thought, oh, as soon as she sees me, she's going to take off. So I tried to stay very still and very quiet, and she didn't take off. Instead, she moved till she was just a few inches from my feet. And then she went to sleep.
She went to sleep?
She took a little mouse nap.
You mean on you or just in front of
you? No, just in front of me. Just a few inches.
Huh?
She was close enough that I could see the really rapid beating of her heart.
Whoa.
It was just as exciting as encounters I had with, you know, big, sexy animals in Africa.
Why?
Because it was just so unexpected that a little mouse would feel comfortable taking a nap at my feet. Then she woke up and she went on with her business.
She woke up startled and thought, what have I done? No. She just woke up and went.
She just woke up. Yeah. I stretched a little bit and then, yeah, went off on her way.
So that was just your nap with the mouse.
Yeah.
Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Hurricane Alex put a stop to most oil skimming operations in the Gulf of Mexico this week. The small fishing and shrimp boats that BP has hired to do that job can't work in rough seas. Well, now a much bigger ship has arrived in the Gulf, outfitted with a never-before-tested system to skim oil hundreds of times faster. NPR's Julie Rose has the story.
You know how Kevin Costner supposedly has some kind of oil-water separating device he's volunteered to use on the spill? Well, he's not the only one. BP has received so many suggestions, it's created a hotline to collect them all. More than 100,000 have poured in, though none are as large as this.
The name of the huge oil skimmer makes perfect sense. It's called a whale. 3.5 football fields in length, about 100 yards wide.
As we come around the front, we're going to see the slits, or the jaws as we call them.
That's Frank Masano, who spent the last 2 days ferrying media out to the giant ship, sitting idle on the Mississippi River. He's with a PR firm the ship's owner hired to unleash a torrent of publicity and help cut through red tape that could keep a whale beached. The tricked-out supertanker is the wild brainstorm of an Asian shipping mogul named Nobu Su, who happens to be reclusive. He sent one of his managers, Bob Grantham, to talk to the press.
He was sort of sitting down, watching the details of the spill, and he realized that because it had happened so far offshore, it needed something else, not just the usual skimmer-type ideas. And he immediately thought of this concept of a whale sucking in plankton and then expelling it. And that's truly where the idea came from.
So he ordered the company's newest supertanker to a port in Portugal, where crews hacked huge slits in the bow near the waterline.
We're climbing down a series of metal ladders now into the... It's basically the mouth of the whale. The oily water is going to...
The ship is just a giant floating decanter. The captain will wiggle the ship's nose very slowly, and water will rush through the slats into a series of tanks. As the oil rises to the top, it'll be siphoned off, and the water goes back into the Gulf. Still oily, but less so.
That's one of the hang-ups. Environmental laws say the water needs to be virtually oil-free, so the ship would need a government waiver. Critics of the oil cleanup effort argue that a large-scale disaster is no time to cling to such rules. And to some extent, many environmentalists agree. Here's David Pettit of the Natural Resources Defense Council.
You're looking at the lesser of two evils. If it were up to me, I would let them do that, or at least let them try it. Because let's face it, nothing that BP or the Coast Guard have thought up is doing much good out there.
We are frustrated.
The ship's 30-man crew is eager for a crack at the oil slick, says Chief Engineer Ashish Ghosh.
We have come all the way to USA. We just want to go in the oil field and start our job.
But BP and the Coast Guard still have concerns about the ship. Will it work, for one thing? No one has ever tried to use a supertanker as an oil skimmer. Also, can it maneuver safely in the crowded area near the leaking well? Yesterday, Admiral Thad Allen offered some cautious encouragement.
The owners made an offer to bring it down at their expense and have it operate in the Gulf area to see if it could be effective. We're anxious to find out how effective it will be.
The ship's owners have already spent millions to slice into a perfectly good supertanker without even the promise of being paid by BP. But spokesman Bob Grantham says they're confident it'll work.
Mr. Sue's a very decisive man.
And early this morning, the giant whale of a ship was finally given Coast Guard clearance to ease out of the Mississippi and into the Gulf for a trial run. Julie Rose, NPR News, New Orleans.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The federal government has issued its first long-term forecast for the movement of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. The outlook through the summer suggests that Florida's Atlantic coast is actually at greater risk than much of the state's Gulf coast. But all that depends on a fickle phenomenon known as the loop current. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Ever since oil began spewing from the runaway well in late April, scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have been making short-term forecasts about where the oil would be a few days hence. Now, for the first time, they have a projection that looks at the long-term movement of the oil. NOAA oceanographer Debbie Payton says it's like the difference between having a short-term weather forecast and projecting the climate.
If you want to have a picnic next August, you look at climatology. If you want to have a picnic tomorrow, you look at the weather forecast.
To forecast the oil climate, if you will, Payton and her colleagues collected wind and current data over the past 15 years in the Gulf of Mexico. They added in an oil gusher, appropriately placed off the coast of Louisiana, and put all that information into a computer model. Think of it as the high-speed equivalent of the movie Groundhog Day, starting over and over at the same place, but then left to unfold on its own.
You do a whole bunch of scenarios, and in this case we did 500 different scenarios. Only one of those scenarios will actually happen.
Only time will tell which one wins out, but some scenarios cropped up much more frequently than others. For example, in this model, oil ended up on the Florida coast south of Tampa less than 1% of the time. On the other hand, oil ended up on the Atlantic coast of Florida more often than not. Payton says this kind of simulation is useful for people on the shore who need to plan ahead.
You know, if I live in Brownsville, what's my threat? And if you live in Brownsville, your threat is pretty much nil. But if you live in western Louisiana, perhaps down in the Keys, then you need to be vigilant and make sure that you're paying attention to what's going on.
People in East Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and the Florida Panhandle don't need anyone to tell them that they're at the highest risk of getting oiled. The model is right on the money there. But the model could be wrong in other ways. For example, currents in the Gulf this year are atypical in some important ways. In particular, a Gulf current called the loop current, which normally pushes water out of the Gulf and up the Atlantic seaboard, doesn't seem to be doing that right now. So the statistically likely scenario of oil in the Keys and into the Atlantic is less of a worry, at least for now.
The scenario that's playing out right now, that's not happening.
The other important wild card here is what happens when a tropical storm or a hurricane blows through. Again, this year is far from typical. In fact, forecasters say it could be a record-breaking year for tropical cyclones in the Gulf. At a meeting on Capitol Hill earlier this week, oceanographer Rick Ludick from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill said these storms will change the flow of oil in the Gulf. They set up huge counterclockwise wind patterns.
As you make that counterclockwise rotation around the Gulf, you push things to the western Louisiana, you push things to Texas, areas that haven't seen them, but you also push them up against the Mississippi Delta.
which could mean pushing oil into some marshes that have so far been relatively unscathed. What actually happens to the oil will ultimately depend on the short-term weather patterns, not the climate. So Debbie Payton at NOAA says keep watching those weather forecasts. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thousands of birds and other wildlife have died in the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, and now marine biologists are increasingly worried about sea turtles. Each year, thousands of baby sea turtles scramble from their nests in the Florida Panhandle sandy beaches and Alabama's coast into the water. But if those Gulf waters are followed by oil and chemical dispersants, a whole generation of sea turtles could be harmed, even destroyed. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is attempting a daring rescue to save those hatchlings. We're joined now by agency spokesman Chuck Underwood at member station WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida. Mr. Underwood, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
How are you going to try and save these sea turtles?
Well, biologists have been working for the past 8 weeks on a plan that has been developed to actually physically relocate the nests that are along the northern Gulf Coast of Florida and Alabama, and take those nests over to the east coast of Florida, where they'll be allowed to complete their incubation, and hopefully the turtles will emerge, we can collect them, and release them to the ocean.
What's that involve, moving the nests of sea turtles?
Oh, this is an extraordinary effort under some very extraordinary circumstances. We've got 700 to 800 nests that are located along these beaches. That represents anywhere from 50 to 70,000 individual hatchlings and eggs. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do now is we've developed some protocols. We've got people who are already permitted. They've already been out for the past 3 months, marking nests as they are laid, collecting data for us. At some point in a couple of weeks, we will begin to actually be able to go out physically by hand, dig these nests up, place them in styrofoam containers, and prepare them for transport to the other side of Florida.
And when you talk about transport, I mean, they don't make baby seats for baby turtle hatchlings, right?
No, they do not. What we've done is we looked at a variety of options for us, everything from just basic vans to using aircraft. We thought at one point, in fact, the plan act, as it's written right now, actually calls for aircraft transport. I decided that it was inherently too dangerous to the eggs with takeoff turbulence and potential weather delays. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, there's actually companies out there who have specialized equipment, and FedEx has stepped up to the plate to do that.
FedEx?
FedEx.
Who signs for the delivery?
We actually have biologists at the other end who would be happy to sign for those deliveries.
Where will they be transported?
They're going to be moved from up and down the coast. The FedEx will go through each day that we have collections made and then transport them over to the Kennedy Space Center. The Space Center has provided the opportunity for us to utilize one of their large climate-controlled warehouses. They have a wildlife contractor on staff that is used to handling wildlife, so they've offered that up to us, and that's a great opportunity for us.
My gosh, so you have this uncommon mutual effort between the latest space technology and, if I might put it this way, one of the oldest technologies of all.
That is correct. It's a very unique situation for us. We have a lot of partners involved that normally would not necessarily all agree to something, but a general consensus is this is at least an opportunity to try to do something in a situation that has been less than ideal for wildlife and will continue to be so in the near future.
And I have to ask, Mr. Underwood, there must be some risk, which I imagine you've calculated, to the hatchlings themselves.
This is one of the reasons we refer to this as an extraordinary effort. This has got just tons and tons of potential risk to it. This is not the best solution. This is the least offensive solution of a bunch of poor solutions. We know with some certainty that if we don't do something, these hatchlings are going to emerge. They're going to go into the Gulf, and the chance in the Gulf would be almost nil. So this is an effort to do what we can. We've tried to minimize the risk, manage those risks to the greatest extent possible, but we do expect that we will, in fact, cause some additional losses.
Yeah. And is there also some risk after they arrive, and does it foul up their internal guidance system?
Those are some of the things we don't know. Once we get them there and they emerge, there's a lot of questions. Are they going to be put on the beach and released into the surf? And are they going to go into the ocean like they would normally do? Or are they going to do circles? We just honestly don't know. Mm.
So on the whole, you've chosen to take this risk, which at least has the promise of giving them a chance at life, whereas if you left them in the Gulf, it sounds as if they'd have no chance whatsoever.
That is correct. We at least give them a chance to get out there. We're not impacting the sea turtle population that's already along the Atlantic side. Many of these turtles that emerge from the northern Gulf nest end up on the Atlantic side naturally anyway, as they get caught into the currents and follow the currents around, the loop current around the Keys. So that would not be unusual.
And, you know, they're in unfamiliar waters there. Where will they wind up?
We won't know for 35 years. This is a very slow maturing species. That 35 years from now, they will reach their sexual maturity and begin coming back to the beaches. At that point, we might be able, through some genetics, figure out which of the turtles coming back on board, particularly the young turtles, might be from the North Gulf. They may end up coming right back to the Eastern Atlantic. We just don't know.
Chuck Underwood, Public Information Officer with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, speaking from Jacksonville, Florida. Thanks so much.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
There'll be no Independence Day celebration in Grand Isle, Louisiana this year. The oil spill that's fouling Gulf Coast waters and beaches is also keeping tourists away. The owner of a small hotel and marina in Grand Isle typically pays for a fireworks show to celebrate, but this year, her only customers are workers who are cleaning up nearby beaches. NPR's Jeff Brady visited Grand Isle yesterday and found a pretty gloomy atmosphere on this holiday weekend.
I'm standing in the parking lot of Bridgeside Marina in Grand Isle, a couple hours south of New Orleans. The owner here, Dodi Vega, says just about any other year, it would be packed, cheek to jowl. But aside from a few work trucks, the place is empty. Over the four decades her family has owned this business, Vega says Grand Isle has become an Independence Day tradition for a lot of families in Louisiana.
4th of July is a weekend you barbecue and you bowl seafood. And you fish, you go to the beach, the island has everything for that.
This year, though, the beaches are closed. There are even guards to keep people away. And there's no fishing allowed with oil in the water. In Vegas's store, there's a rack that used to display fishing poles for sale. Instead of poles, there are push brooms used to scrub oil off the side of boats. And the tackle and other fishing supplies on the shelves have been replaced with hard hats and safety vests. Vegas started stocking these items, hoping to make up for the lost business from tourists. Even now, it seems like she can't believe what's happening.
We have no kids. We have no families. We just have workers. So we decided not to put on our fireworks show, and we couldn't afford it anyway.
Each year, Vegas spends about $10,000 for fireworks and music. The 1,500 people who call Grand Isle home will have to find some other way to celebrate the 4th this year. Outside in a covered area that usually houses the band on July 4th, it's empty and some boys are playing basketball. 16-year-old George Torres says these are hard times.
My stepdad's a yard foreman for all our company. He's not going to lose his job because they have work coming in. But the work, it's getting slow. The hours are cut. Instead of working 12 hours a day, he works 10.
Folks around here generally work in one of three industries, oil, tourism, or seafood. Robert Collins' family falls into that last category.
My family has been in the seafood business for four generations, and now it's a matter of asking, is that going to end? Will it keep on going? How long can we survive?
Those are the long-term questions these boys have. But George Torres also wonders about the short-term. What's he going to do this weekend?
It's boring down here not to see all your friends that come down every year for 4th of July. You don't get to see them all year round. You hope to see them for 4th of July in Tarpon, and I don't know if they're going to be here.
Back inside Dodi Vegas' store, there's a steady line of workers ordering po' boys and pizza back in the deli. But she knows it should be even busier than this. She hasn't had to lay anyone off yet, but she wasn't able to hire all the summer help she usually takes on when school lets out. Vega says she's worried about the future of her business.
So it just depends on what this oil does to the fishing here, you know, and then how many years is going to take to come back. It's a big, huge worry. So.
Are you sleeping okay?
No. 3 o'clock every morning, it seems like I'm wide awake.
And Vega says some nights she can't get to sleep at all. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Grand Isle, Louisiana.